Accession number 28670, Mr. David Wilson, Reel 12. Now, is there anything else about your time at Fayed or any other things that happened that you want to bring to our attention?
Well, it's been mostly through the incidents that I can recall and the atmosphere and the general sort of tenure of the place. I know it was, you always felt threatened when you were out of camp, and there were plenty of incidents to underline that. It wasn't a good posting in that sense. The experience was the thing that I, in retrospect, there were some aspects of it that I enjoyed. Mainly on the technical side, becoming capable and the status. I mean, by the time you're out there and having two tapes and having a sort of reputation, being with the regiment a reasonable period of time, well known in the regiment, and having the status to go with it. Whereas, you know, if I hadn't been there, hadn't done that, I would have been a mechanic in a garage somewhere with certainly a lesser light altogether. So at 19 year old, 19 coming up 20, it was, I was, I felt quite elevated.
Now, how long were you out there for? You'd arrived in May 53.
May 53. It come towards the end of, well, the middle of May 54.
Now, what happened as you reached, I mean, because you were, you were a national serviceman, you knew when you were going home.
Right? Oh, yes, yes.
How did you wind down, or did you wind down, or were you replaced, or did you have to train your replacement?
We worked right up to, I was the first one demobbed from the regiment, of the national serviceman that I knew. And the from the Middle East, that is. And right up till the last couple of days, we were, I and my pal Ed Potter were involved in quite major jobs. In fact, we had just started, although it wasn't technically allowed, we had just started changing the engine on a Cromwell, which was big stuff. There's a lot of disconnections and a lot of paraphernalia, a lot of shrouded wiring and all the rest of it. And of course, it's a big motor. It's a much, much bigger job than and more complicated than the SPs. Didn't get it fit. I came away with the engine out. So I don't know if I got it fitted. I got the new one in place.
Now, what happened when you left? Was there any sort of party to send you off for or anything about that?
Had a party in the Nuffy the night before and got pretty, you know, stewed.
What was a demob party like?
It was the usual sort of, the fact that there was no entertainment in and around the camp. You had to make your own. You obviously, after they had a few beers, you got the amateur singers and comedians on the stage. There was a bit of that, and I was, I suppose, frog marched into singing Geordie songs generally, that's about all I can remember, Blade and Races and this sort of thing. Got a few beers, had a hangover the morning afterwards when I paraded in the guardroom with all my kit. And there used to be a duty truck used to come along right along the Treaty Road picking demobbies up at each guardroom. And I was the only one, as I say, to get on from ours. And then you were way down through the camp centre and away along the Treaty Road to Portside. And when you got to Portside, there was a stack of blokes there. They were coming from all of the other units, obviously. And the RTO took charge and you know, sort of mustered everybody in. But the troop ship, obviously, I flew out, but I came back on the trooper, and it was the Dilwara.
Dilwara.
And it was the first trooper out of Port Said after the incident with the Empire Windrush, which went down in 54 in the Med. It caught fire. So safety measures that were taken were, well, they were horrendous.
What sort of thing?
Well, when we finally set sail, we had boat stations every 5 minutes, practicing mustering at boat stations and practicing fire drill. It was mainly fire drill. But prior to getting on the boat, we onto the Dilwara, we had to assemble on shore and board this lighter. I'm calling it a lighter. It was a sort of barge, and if I recall correctly, it didn't have a proper guardrail around, around the extremities of it. And I remember getting pushed towards the edge when my kid bag balanced on top of a big pack, and feeling very insecure as if I was, going to get pushed into the drink. Anyway, we got out into the harbour, the Dilwara lay quite a way off, maybe half a mile, into the harbour, and then we had to clamber aboard the Dilwara up a sort of rope gangway, and got on board, allocated your troop deck. Ours was right down in the bowels of the thing. Troop deck F, I think it was.
What was the troop deck like?
Oh, it was horrible. It was, they weren't hammocks as such, they were beds, but they were in long rows, and they were three high. You had, there was not just two, but three cots, one on top of the other, in long lines, double-sided on. On each side, there was a tubular steel pillar, and you had these long lines. And of course, the smell was horrible. You couldn't get rid of it. Just the smell of bodies, unwashed soldiery. And of course, it had come from the Far East, so there was already guys on board. From what I remember, it was the Inniskillen Fusiliers, mainly, along with other personnel. And we got settled in, found a bunk, put your kit beside it and stash the kit bags in the corner. the kit bags had gone into the hold, that's right, yeah. But the rest of your kit you stashed in the corner. And went up on deck, and one of these Egyptian gilly-gilly men, a sort of conjurer, had come on board. And I recall him, little fat chap with a fez, red fez, and he came on board with it, didn't seem to have any props at all, but within a matter of minutes the decks were covered with dear old chicks, little yellow chicks scuttling about all over the place. Well, he couldn't have them in his hat, it wasn't big enough, though, you know. Where he got them from, I've no idea, but I thought it was very clever. And then he did a few other tricks, and then he went ashore. And then the bum boats came alongside selling leather goods. And there was a dispute between some of the Inniskillens, and this guy had sent a handbag or something up, and they reckoned they hadn't paid for it. And the Inniskillens started throwing bottles at this guy. So he backed off and cursed them and blistered the sides of the boat with his comments, you know. We sailed, and it was quite rough. I remember, particularly after I'm still suffering from the hangover, I felt a bit queasy, to say the least. And we, first night, we saw a film, they ran a film on deck. The Navy had this screen rigged up on deck, and they ran a film. It was the guy, they did the great Caruso, the singer that did the Student Prince and that sort of, Mario Lanza. In all the way through the Med, we saw four Mario Lanza films. It must have been the only ones they had in stock. And we sailed on. I remember that sitting up on deck at a night time, and it was when it was calm, and it was sort of sultry and very close atmosphere, quite warm, and you could hear the ship's engine, obviously a big diesel, pumming away, you know, and it was all very pleasant. The only snag, one of the snags on board was if you were an NCO, you had to do at least one duty on the way back. And of course, it took about a fortnight to get back. But you either did one permanent duty, like IC of a troop deck cleaning party, or you did one, say, guard mountain or some other sort of official duty.
Which did you get?
I got both, as it happened. I got, and what happened was, I got into the ship's RSM's bad books because not having anybody to refer to when I left the regiment, I had packed me battle dress, me BD, in me kit bag. But by the time you came to Malta, you had to change from KD into BD. And of course, guess where mine was? In the hold, in the kit bag. So I had to go to the ship's RSM and come clean. So I got put in charge of a kit bag moving party down in the hold. Ended up moving hundreds and hundreds of kit bags before I found mine. Got me BD out and dressed accordingly. And of course, I got two duties. I was in charge troop deck at IC troop deck cleaning party, and also I got stuck with two IC marching in relief on as a guard on guard, and they had these SES guys on board, and they were in the clink, they were in the ship's cells, because they had gone ashore in Singapore, and they had come, there was three or four of them, and they had come back to the docks in a rickshaw or two rickshaws, and they had a dispute about the fare. So they ended up tipping the rickshaws and the coolies, the rickshaw coolies, into the water, and they had to be fished out. So they were in clink, and they wouldn't, they completely lacked any sort of discipline. They were just wouldn't do what you said, to march them down to get their meal and then take it back again. So that was the other duty I did. So say it was about a fortnight from Port Said to Southampton, and then we landed at Southampton. We had to go through the customs, which I thought was ridiculous.
Now, how strict was the customs?
Very strict. Had people emptying all their gear out, you know. And I mean, this was 1954. It was in people just didn't have that sort of money, and there was nobody bringing in any contraband, anything worth talking about. But anyway, they went through the kit bags and the webbing, and then we entrained for Aldershot. Spent about a week in Aldershot. It was demobbed a few days late. Back to Newcastle, and I was posted to the 43rd Royal Tanks to do.
Now hang on, what about your that's your TA duty? TA,
right.
So what was the demobilisation process you went through? That's in June, is it?
Early June.
So what happened? What is it? How do they demobilise it?
Well, the camp itself was quite, there wasn't any regimental, it was free and easy. You met a lot of your old acquaintances that you had rubbed shoulders with in training. Swapping stories, and it was generally, there wasn't any muster parades. You were mainly spending your time going back and forth at the company office to see when and what was happening. You got into the town quite a bit, into Aldershot.
This is Aldershot.
Yeah. And then eventually when your particulars come up on part one orders, and you know, you just parade, and of course you parade, you go to your pay parade, and you get your final sort of, you hear the bad news about how much they've stopped from your pay because of lost kit. I mean, you're halfway around the world, lost at mine. I lost a great coat, which was, but yeah, I mean, you just didn't use it in the Middle East at all. I forget where it went. It was probably pinched out of the tent. I lost a great coat and a couple of pairs of gloves or something like that. And I was docked about 15 quid or something from me final.
That's
pay.
A lot then.
It was. That was a lot of money. I was most upset about that. And then
did they give you a suit still of that old suit?
No, I came back with me uniform. It was only lost the uniform when the TA was finished. And you had to do 3.5 years with the TA.
So that was it, just the charges for lost kit. Was there a final medical?
No, not at all. No. Nothing. It was just a question of hanging about waiting for clearance to...
I'll come to your TA service later, but when you came out, what were you going to do? You know, I mean...
Well, because of the fact that I went in at 18, being an indentured apprentice, I could have been deferred until I was 21, but I was too impatient for that, so I went in when I was 18, which was your prerogative.
You were an apprentice motor mechanic.
Yes, at Murray and Charlton's in Newcastle.
Were you keen to go back? So what
yes,
were you do?
Yes. Partly the motivation was to see the lads and to sort of swing the lamp and tell the tale and this sort of thing. And
would you be still an apprentice, or did it?
Yes, until you were 21. Yeah, I was still an apprentice. The firms were duty bound to keep the jobs open for you at the time, till you could either be deferred and serve your apprenticeship and then do your national service, or you do your national service, come back to the same firm and finish off your apprenticeship then, which I did. And I must admit, getting back to sort of thinking in retrospect about the army service, about the national service in particular, I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Now, what had it done for you, good and bad then, do you think?
Well, on the positive side, it taught me about life. It taught me even how to look after myself personally. Even things like, you know, your clothing and bit of ironing and cleanliness and tidying your living space, keeping it tidy and generally looking after yourself and looking out for yourself. And self-discipline, I suppose. But on the technical side, on my job side, I learned a tremendous amount in the army. And I came out a much better tradesman for it. I was way ahead of my contemporaries that hadn't been into the forces or were medically unfit or something like that. And I found that even, you know, today I can still quote things like horsepower of Wright's radial whirlwind engine, because it all stuck, you know, it's stuff that stuck with me and techniques and being. And of course, when you were in the forces, as I say, as a 19, 20-year-old, with all this responsibility and all this expensive equipment at your mercy, let's say, if you're good or bad, and all of a sudden you come back home and you're just down to an average motor mechanic trying to earn a living somewhere, you know, in a garage.
Now, how did you... you've been in for 2 years, basically.
Yeah.
Year and 3, I can't remember what it is.
It was 2 years. It was 2 full years.
How did you acclimatise? Because when you're 19, 2 years is a long time.
Yes,
how did you acclimatise back to being a civilian lifestyle?
Badly. I didn't enjoy it at all.
Now, what were your problems?
It's the travel aspect, in not getting around, being stuck in one place. Go to work in a garage and working, at the time it was 44 hours a week, 8 till 5, 5 days in the Saturday morning. Lack of freedom, the comradeship as well, it's not the same in the forces. You're living cheek by jowl with blokes, some you like, some you don't. But the guys you do get on with, you come very close, and there was none of that in civilian life. You did your job, you came home, and that was it, sort of stuff. A couple of mates maybe used to go out for a drink, but it wasn't the same as the forces, and I missed it. In fact, at one stage I regretted, because you were pressed, I mean, if you were any good, particularly as a tradesman, you were pressed occasionally by senior NCOs to sign on, because it was the 21-year lark at the time with 3-year option. And I wasn't really keen to sign on when I was in, but after I got out and realised that I missed it, I could have been talked into signing on and going back as a regular.
NCO,
yeah. Because immediately I would have been put in for, in fact, that was one of the sweeteners, one of the temptations they used when they tried to encourage you to sign on, was that you would immediately go for an armament artificer's course, at which time you would be made up to sergeant. And on passing it, you would be made up to staff sergeant. So you had two steps, two promotions that would have been rapid. And of course, the obvious pay increase to boot. So I was kind of, but then I met my wife, and that was the end of the any thoughts about joining up.
Now tell me about we'll come to the TA stuff in a minute, but what about your career what did you do? You're an apprentice motor mechanic. You qualified, obviously.
Oh yes, I finished my time.
So what was your career then? What did you do for a living?
Well, it was general repairs. I worked, the firm that I worked for was the Austin Distributors in Newcastle. They were the old Austin Distributors in the world. Old Murray negotiated with Herbert Austin before he was Sir Herbert Austin for motor cars in the 20s. And so I worked for them doing every aspect of motor car repair that there is. And then started, particularly when I was first married, started looking for jobs with more money. And I moved from garage to garage for a few pence an hour more, doing the same sort of thing. And of course, every time you moved, you had to prove that you were a capable mechanic. And eventually got to the stage where I got foreman's jobs as I became, you know, with a bit of seniority. And ended up as assistant service manager at a Ford dealership in Newcastle in the 60s. That was R.H. Patterson. And then from there, I became an insurance engineer for a commercial union, and I retired from there. So it was all motor trade, but it was the sort of at the finish it was like the sort of administrative echelon of the thing, rather than hands on. But I still like hands on jobs. You know, I still enjoy it.
Now tell me about your now, which were the TA regiment you had to join? It was
well, the regiment I was supposed to do first off was the 43rd Royal Tank Regiment. It was the LAD to the 43rd Royal Tank Regiment.
And where were they based?
They were based in Newcastle at St Mary's Place, at St George's Drill Hall.
How did that? I mean, what was your commitment to them?
Well, you had to do the annual camp, and you had to do 2 parades a month at the drill hall, minimum. The first annual camp with the 43rd Royal Tanks
probably do drill hall. What was a drill hall night like? Firstly, I mean, it's my fault. What was the regiment like? How did you feel when you joined them?
I was quite happy. The 43rd Royal Tanks were quite a historic regiment. There's a memorial to them in the Haymarket at Newcastle, and it's the St George and the Dragon, just beside St Thomas's Church. And for that, it's a Second World War memorial to specifically for them. And they were there right through the whole thing, from with the BEF before Dunkirk, and right through the war. And I was quite happy to be with them.
What did you think of the setup of the unit when you joined them?
Well, it was. They had an old Churchill ERV, which I got to drive on in fact, I was lumbered with it, literally, on the summer camp. and but mainly drill nights were.
But what sort of unit? I mean, what tanks did they have? What how many were there? Where was it based? Or did you not really know much of that?
I don't know what their strength was. There was one reason for this, because within a very short space of time, they converted infantry.
Right. So what tank did they have? I'm not sure.
I can't recall.
Okay. So what was it? What were you doing on a drill night? What was your job on a drill night?
Well, a drill night mainly was just attending, and they would organise maybe a lecture. Senior NCO would give a lecture on something.
You were in as a corporal, were you?
Yes, I was still a full corporal.
Was there no practical side, or was it just lecturing?
Not for the LAD. It was just a lecture. I mean, there was civilian employees in any case for the main LAD work, and I think the NS, the National Service, ex-colours National Servicemen were, in a sense, I think they were regarded as a little bit of a nuisance.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I overheard one of the senior NCOs say, in fact, this is he gets to the Western Front, say that National Servicemen, he couldn't be bothered with them because they didn't really want to be there, which wasn't true, certainly not with me. And
you were keen enough then?
Well, certainly, I was a little bit, I suppose, in a sense, I felt a little bit superior, because I had just come away from doing what I consider to be a good job in a line regiment in a foreign posting, and to come back to Newcastle and be pushed around by TA guys I didn't really take to it very well, but I didn't react to it. But I felt it,
Now, were you introduced to your vehicle at all, this Churchill ARV, at the drill hall, or was that...
No, that was at Castle Martin in...
Tell us about this annual camp then.
Well, the first annual camp was Castle Martin near Pembroke Dock in South Wales. And it was a very dry summer, I recall. And the terrain was dried up to the point of being... I remember the soil was red, so you had loads of red dust. And of course, when the armour was moving, and particularly with me following it with this Churchill ERV, which was very slow by comparison.
What was it like?
It was a horrible thing, really.
What was horrible about it?
Well, as opposed to the Sherman, and of course the Cromwell and the Comet, the Churchill had this Liberty engine in. It was termed a Liberty engine. It was a V12, just the same as the Rolls Royce, except that they inclined the cylinder banks to one another at an angle of 45 degrees. There was narrow angle, as against the 90 degrees of the Meteor. And it had a different sound for a start. And it always felt woolly to me, lacking the power that the Rolls had. And really the road speed was little more than 15 miles an hour. That's all I could get out of the damn thing. And of course, you used to crawl along. And with it being a dusty summer, a dry summer, this red dust was as bad as any in the desert. And it used to get into everything, and it cake with it being sort of soil dust that used to cake your hair, so that it was like you're wearing a busby or a steel helmet. And the wash went in under canvas again. Tents with dug boards down, and the washing facilities were primitive. They were just a long trough with a corrugated iron cover over, and there was a tap about every 6 feet along this trough. And you either got superheated steam, which scalded you, or it was stone cold, and generally it was stone cold. So if it was cold, you couldn't even make a lather with the soap, and all this caked, matted mud in your hair and on your body was it was almost impossible to get off. And it was the conditions were pretty poor, to be quite honest.